Imagine you were walking into like a high-stakes marketing meeting.
Oh boy, I can picture it already.
Right. So the lights are dimmed, the projector is humming, and the presenter clicks to the big slide. And in giant bold numbers, it says, "We just added 100,000 new contacts to our database."
And let me guess, everyone starts cheering.
Exactly. Everyone around the table starts clapping. I mean,
Yep.
it feels like a massive win, you know? It
Yeah.
feels like guaranteed sales are just around the corner.
Yeah, but that's the trap.
It is. Because what if I told you that entire room is actually celebrating an illusion?
A very expensive illusion.
Spot on. Well, welcome back to another deep dive. We are so thrilled to see our resident learner returning for this one.
Definitely. It is great to have you back with us.
So whether you are prepping for a boardroom meeting of your own or, actively evaluating your company's sales pipeline, or maybe you're just deeply curious about the hidden mechanics of modern B2B growth engines, this is a mission-critical discussion.
It really is. We're getting into the weeds today.
We are. We are unpacking a highly comprehensive article from May 2026. It's by Lauren Popeck from Reach Marketing.
Yeah, and the title really says it all. It's called How to Build a B2B Email List for Lead Generation the Right Way.
The right way, which implies there's a very wrong way. And our primary goal today is to dismantle a very common misconception in the business world.
Yeah, the pervasive myth that volume equals velocity.
Right.
We have been so heavily conditioned by like early internet marketing tactics to just think bigger is inherently better.
Just grab as many emails as possible.
Exactly. The assumption is that if you pump more data, more emails, and more raw leads into the top of the funnel.
Then revenue will just inevitably fall out of the pocket.
Exactly. And it just doesn't work like that anymore.
Okay, let's unpack this. The central thesis of this source fundamentally rejects that old funnel math
Completely rejects it.
because volume is absolutely not the goal here. Qualified pipeline is.
Right. Chasing massive contact counts is essentially a rookie mistake.
It creates a false sense of security,
Yeah,
right?
yeah. Yeah, while actively diluting your actual sales efforts. I mean, the companies that are dominating their sectors right now, they're prioritizing account fit.
Account shit over everything.
Yeah, and demanding rigorously verified data and, deploying incredibly smart segmentation.
The focus has shifted entirely to precision. I mean, I like to think about it as, well, it's the difference between casting a giant blind fishing net into the ocean versus spear fishing.
Oh, I like that analogy.
Right. Chasing volume means dragging a massive net along the bottom. You are hoping you catch a tuna, but mostly you're pulling up seaweed, old boots, and I don't know, maybe a few jellyfish.
Yeah, and you're wasting a lot of energy doing it.
Exactly. Successful teams are spearfishing. They map the exact waters, the exact depth, and they target the specific fish they know they need.
And that's exactly what the article points out. Asking how many contacts can we get is fundamentally the wrong question.
So, what's the spearfishing question then?
The right question is, which contacts are most likely to need what we offer? Who understands the business value? And who actually holds the internal capital to influence the purchase?
And that distinction completely alters your downstream operations, doesn't it?
Oh, entirely. It leads us into what the source defines as the account-first strategy.
Right, the account-first strategy.
Because in complex B2B sales, I mean, you are almost never dealing with an isolated individual making some rogue unilateral
No
purchase.
one's just swiping a corporate card for 50 grand without talking to anyone.
Exactly. A business purchase involves a complex entity navigating competing internal needs, budget cycles, and intricate decision-making structures.
So an account-first list-building strategy demands that you identify the target companies first.
Validate that those companies fit your profile, and only then do you map out the buying committee inside of them.
Because, yeah, B2B buying is a consensus game now, and the source breaks down this buying committee dynamic brilliantly.
Right.
It really makes the abstract idea of a target account feel, incredibly tangible.
It really does. Give us an example of how that plays out.
Okay, let's say you're selling enterprise revenue intelligence software.
Yeah.
You need multiple entry points, right?
Always.
So the CMO might be the one who ultimately signs off on the overarching campaign budget.
Right.
But the sales leader is the one scrutinizing the actual lead routing capabilities.
And then you have the business owner evaluating the total cost of ownership.
Exactly. And don't forget, the operations manager. They are the one actually dealing with the daily nightmare of the current broken tech stack.
And this is where the spearfishing comes in. If you target only the business owner with a highly technical message about like integration times,
They'll just ignore it.
yeah, they will completely ignore it because they don't feel that specific operational pain.
Right. They just care about the bottom line.
Conversely, if you secure massive buy-in from the ops manager, but you completely fail to engage the CMO who actually controls the budget,
the deal stalls indefinitely.
Exactly. Multi-contact coverage across that entire committee is not optional. It is the only way to insulate your deal from internal bottlenecks. You are effectively surrounding the account.
Okay, but wait. I'm going to play devil's advocate for a second here.
Oh, go for it.
If we're targeting a committee, why isn't a verified email enough to just drop them in a sequence and let the copy do the work?
I hear this all the time.
Right. If I've identified the right company, and I have the names and, you know, technically valid email addresses for the CMO, the sales leader, and the ops manager, can't I just launch a campaign and let the strongest message win?
Well, what's fascinating here is that an email address alone, completely devoid of context, is essentially useless.
Useless, really?
The source is adamant about this. A technically valid email simply means the message won't bounce back to your server.
That's it.
That's literally it. It says absolutely nothing about relevance. Without deep contextual data attached to that record, your messaging defaults to generic platitudes.
Oh, right. And generic messaging to a highly specialized buying committee
is a guaranteed way to get ignored. Or worse, marked as spam.
Okay, knowing we need all this granular data to avoid sounding tone deaf makes sense in theory. But we have to look at the reality of the data itself.
For sure.
The source breaks down a contact record into core fields and advanced segmentation fields. I assume the core fields are just the baseline table stakes.
Yeah, they are the absolute minimum required to pass basic sorting logic in your CRM.
So we're talking about first and last name, business email,
specific job title and department,
company name and website,
industry, company size, location, and crucial metadata like verification status.
Right, because without those, your system literally cannot route the lead or even personalize a basic hi first name greeting.
Exactly. But the advanced segmentation fields are where the spear phishing actually happens.
Yeah, the article lists fields like the company's current technology stack, which is huge.
Massive.
Because if I know a prospect uses Salesforce versus HubSpot, my pitch changes entirely. I'm not just saying, hey, we integrate with your CRM.
Right, that's generic.
Instead, I'm saying our native Salesforce integration cuts your think time by 40%.
It proves you actually know their business. The source also highlights things like recent hiring activity, funding stage, estimated revenue,
purchase signals or intent data.
Yeah, and current vendor relationships. Consider how a recent Series B funding round fundamentally alters the psychological state of a buyer.
Oh, they suddenly have a massive mandate to scale.
Exactly. They have board pressure to deploy that capital efficiently. If your advanced segmentation data alerts you to that funding event,
your messaging shifts from like saving money to accelerating time to market.
Spot on. That is the power of intent data and advanced segmentation. But this level of detail also exposes the brutal consequences of bad data.
Let's talk about those consequences, because the article makes it sound like bad data isn't just a missed opportunity. It's like a systemic contagion.
It is. It creates a highly toxic ripple effect across your entire revenue operation.
Give me an example.
Well, if you have outdated job titles, you are sending highly specific, role-based messaging to someone who no longer holds that responsibility.
Oh, that makes you look so out of touch.
You look totally incompetent and it damages your brand credibility instantly. Or what if you have duplicate records?
Oh, your automation might trigger the same message to a prospect 3 times in 1 week.
Exactly. And beyond the frontline embarrassment of that, bad data destroys your internal reporting.
Right, because you can't accurately forecast your pipeline.
Or calculate conversion rates if the underlying data set is just polluted with inactive accounts and duplicate entries.
So data hygiene is literally a mandatory operational requirement.
Not just a nice to have.
But that brings up a massive logistical problem.
Let's hear it.
Knowing we need all this granular intent, funding, and tech stack data is great. But manually researching this for 5,000 target accounts would take an internal sales team a decade.
It's impossible.
So how is this actually scalable? Do we build it organically over years or do we buy it? Because here's where it gets really interesting. In a lot of sophisticated marketing circles, buying a list is treated like a taboo.
It's a huge taboo.
Right. Every marketer I know treats list buying like a scam that just ruins your domain reputation and gets you blacklisted. So how does the article position this as a viable strategy?
Well, the taboo exists because historically, buying lists meant purchasing stagnant spreadsheets of scraped, completely unverified data.
just junk data.
Exactly. But the source clarifies that acquiring third-party data is absolutely viable and effective, provided you treat it as a strategic procurement process rather than a cheap shortcut.
You can't just buy a list of 10,000 SaaS executives and call it a day.
No, you must subject any data provider to extreme scrutiny. You evaluate partners like Reach Marketing, who the article notes actively manage over 35 million verified contacts based on the rigor of their methodology.
So it's about auditing the supplier, not just looking at the sheer volume of the inventory.
Precisely. You need to demand data source transparency. Like, how are they acquiring these records? Are they using real-time validation protocols to ensure the emails are still active?
Right. And how frequently is their database scrubbed for job changes? People move around so much now.
Exactly. And most importantly, does their filtering capability actually map to your highly specific ideal customer profile? The problem isn't the acquisition of third-party data.
The problem is lazy, unvetted procurement.
Exactly.
But before anyone signs a contract for a massive new data append, the article takes a hard pivot to something companies perpetually neglect.
Oh, the internal goldmine?
Yes, first-party data. Mm. The source argues that your customer relationship management platform, your CRM, must be the unshakable central record of truth.
Because organizations constantly look outward for net new contacts while completely ignoring the behavioral intelligence sitting dormant in their own systems.
It's crazy.
If your marketing automation platform is operating off one segmented list and your sales development reps are working off a spreadsheet.
Which happens all the time.
All the time. And then leadership is forecasting based on a third disconnected database. Your lead generation engine is basically built on quicksand.
Yeah, and the existing database is usually treated like a graveyard. It's full of old leads that went cold or opportunities that lost to a competitor 2 years ago.
Inactive customers.
Right, and trade show badge scans from like 2024. Yes, those records need aggressive data hygiene, but the source argues they contain a proprietary asset that third-party data will never have.
Historical context.
Exactly.
And historical context is the ultimate competitive differentiator. Raw third-party data can tell you that a company fits your profile, but first-party historical data, that tells you that this specific account has evaluated your product twice in the last 4 years.
And maybe stalled at the proposal stage both times because of implementation concerns.
Yes. It tells you which specific subject lines have historically resonated with specific job titles in your unique market.
So the most formidable B2B lists are hybrids. They leverage the historical, contextual foundation of first-party CRM data, and then they intelligently layer in highly targeted, verified third-party data to expand the total addressable market.
That is the winning formula.
Okay, let's assume we've built this utopian hybrid list. It's pristine. We have first-party context layered with advanced third-party intent data.
A beautiful thing.
We have a buying committee mapped out. The immediate instinct is to load it into a sequencer and just blast it out.
Whoa, stop right there.
Right, the article throws cold water on that pretty quickly.
Right.
Because having the perfect data doesn't give you the technical or legal right to actually deliver it.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, ignoring the infrastructure of email delivery is catastrophic.
It's like building a multi-million dollar sports car, but forgetting to pave the road you're going to drive it on.
That's a great way to put it. Compliance and deliverability aren't just administrative checkboxes to avoid regulatory fines. They dictate whether you have a functioning channel at all. If you fail to respect these technical rules, mailbox providers will silently route your communications straight to the spam folder,
rendering your perfect data completely useless.
Entirely useless.
So the source outlines the legal baseline first. In the United States, we operate under canned spam.
Which is relatively straightforward.
Yeah. You must use accurate header information, meaning you cannot spoof the from address to look like, say, an internal company memo.
Yeah.
You cannot use deceptive subject lines, and you absolutely must provide a clear, frictionless mechanism to unsubscribe.
However, international campaigns introduce massive complexity.
Oh, yeah.
If your list includes contacts in the European Union or Canada, you are operating under frameworks like GDPR or CASL.
And those are no joke.
They really aren't. The source mentions explicit consent and legitimate interest. Under GDPR, you cannot simply email someone just because you found their address on LinkedIn.
Right.
You either need their explicit opt-in consent or you must rely on legitimate interest.
And legitimate interest requires you to prove that your communication offers genuine, relevant value connected to their specific professional role.
And crucially, the burden of proof is on you, the sender.
Wow. Okay, and even if your lawyers sign off on the compliance side of things, the technical gatekeepers still have to let you in.
The fun stuff.
Yeah, the article gets deep into the weeds on domain authentication, specifically highlighting SPF, DKIMM, and DMRC.
Those acronyms intimidate a lot of people.
They really do, but they are the bedrock of deliverability. I like to think of them like an international customs border for your digital packages.
That is the perfect framework to understand the mechanism. Break it down for us.
Okay, so SPF, or Sender Policy Framework, is essentially the border guard checking the license plate of the delivery truck.
Okay.
It verifies that the IP address sending the email is officially authorized by your company's domain.
Makes sense.
Then DKIM acts as a cryptographic wax seal on the package itself. It proves to the receiving server that the contents of the email were not altered or intercepted while in transit.
And DMRC is the overarching instruction manual for those border guards. It ties SPF and DKIM together and explicitly tells the receiving server what to do, whether to quarantine the email or reject it entirely, if a message fails those first two authentication checks.
Right, so if your technical team hasn't properly configured DMRs, sophisticated corporate firewalls will reject your emails on principle.
Regardless of how relevant or personalized the message is.
Which brings us to domain warm-up. Let's say all the customs paperwork is flawless. You still can't just show up on day one with 50,000 packages.
Definitely not.
The article stresses that if you launch a massive volume spike from a brand new sending infrastructure, mailbox providers like Google and Microsoft will immediately flag the behavior as anomalous algorithmic spam.
You'll be blocked in an hour.
So you have to start by sending a tiny volume of emails to highly engaged contacts, gradually increasing the daily limit over weeks.
Just to mechanically build trust with the global spam filters.
Exactly.
Well, this raises an important question. Let's assume the entire technical gauntlet is cleared.
Okay.
The domains are warmed, the authentication is ironclad, the compliance is documented, and the emails are consistently landing in the primary inbox.
And we're actually generating replies.
Yes. How do we ensure this operational success translates into measurable business revenue?
The activation phase.
Because, as the source acutely notes, volume without strategic segmentation is just noise that completely overwhelms your sales team.
We have to map our segmentation to the scoring models. The exact same core product has to be positioned completely differently depending on the role of the recipient.
Right.
Returning to our enterprise software example, the CEO does not care about API endpoints.
It could not care less.
They care about market share and operating margins. But the marketing director, they care about velocity.
The underlying software is identical, but the buying logic is entirely localized to the segment.
So segmentation dictates the message.
But lid scoring dictates the deployment of human capital.
Oh, okay.
The source defines a mature lead scoring model as a dynamic matrix of two elements, fit data and engagement data.
Got it.
Fit data is structural. You know, does this company have the right revenue? Are they in the right industry? And does this contact hold the necessary authority?
And engagement data is strictly behavioral. Like, did they open the email, forward it, click the pricing link, or maybe download the technical white paper?
Exactly. And the matrix is where the magic happens.
How so?
Well, if a contact has incredible engagement, let's say they clicked every single link in your sequence,
Okay.
but their fit score is terrible because they are, say, a junior analyst at a company far below your minimum revenue threshold.
Your system should never route them to a senior account executive.
Never. You let marketing automation nurture them. On the flip side, if the CEO of your top-tier target account opens a single email,
That maximum fit score overrides the low initial engagement.
exactly. It triggers an immediate personalized sales motion. The system protects the sales team's time.
That makes total sense.
But to calibrate that scoring matrix, you have to measure reality, not vanity. And this is where the source exposes a critical flaw in modern marketing reporting.
The obsession with open rates.
Oh, yes.
Everyone loves a slide deck that boasts a 45% open rate. But the article explicitly warns that open rates are, at best, merely directional.
And at worst, entirely deceptive.
Why is relying on open rates so dangerous for a B2B pipeline right now?
Because the mechanics of email tracking have fundamentally broken the metric. Take Apple's mail privacy protection as the prime example.
Oh, I've heard about this.
Yeah. When a user enables this, Apple servers automatically prefetch and download all email images in the background,
including the invisible tracking pixels marketers use to record and open.
Exactly. This means your email platform registers a 100% open rate for those users, even if the prospect instantly deleted the email without ever reading a single word.
Wow. So it's the boardroom illusion all over again. Yeah. You are celebrating a technical artifact, not human intent.
Exactly. The source demands a complete shift from activity metrics like open rates and raw click-throughs to actual pipeline metrics.
So we must measure meeting conversion rates.
Yes. Out of the total replies generated, how many actually converted into calendar bookings? What is our qualified lead rate?
And most importantly, what is the closed one revenue generated by specific list segments?
Right. An incredibly targeted campaign that generates only 20 replies, but where 15 of those replies turn into highly qualified pipeline,
is infinitely more valuable to the business than a massive blast that generates hundreds of low intent clicks.
100%.
So what does this all mean? We've covered a tremendous amount of ground today.
We really have.
We move from the necessity of spearfishing over dragging a net. We unpack the deep mechanics of intent data and buying committees.
We navigated the rigorous evaluation of third-party vendors.
Explored the compliance borders of SPF and DKIM. And finally, dismantled the vanity of open rates.
It's a lot to process.
It is. But if there's one overarching doctrine to pull from this reach marketing analysis, it is this. The most catastrophic mistake in B2B list building is prioritizing volume over fit.
Without a doubt.
Inflated contact counts of irrelevant, unverified people provide nothing but a dangerous illusion of progress while fundamentally fracturing your revenue engine.
And if I can leave our listeners with a final thought to mull over, consider the current technological landscape we are in.
Oh, the AI landscape.
Yeah. We are operating in an era where generative AI and advanced automation make it dangerously easy to blast out thousands of highly personalized, grammatically perfect emails a minute.
So easy now.
The technology to be exceptionally loud is now commoditized. It's accessible to everyone. Therefore, the most radical, defensible, competitive advantage a B2B marketer can possess today isn't the ability to shout louder or scale wider.
What is it then?
The ultimate advantage is having the extreme strategic discipline to send fewer emails exclusively to the exact right people.
I love that. Imagine walking back into that high stakes meeting. The projector clicks on. The number on the slide isn't 100,000. It's 500.
But they are the exact right 500 accounts.
Yeah. Thoroughly mapped to the buying committee, validated by intent data, scored for maximum fit, and primed for a real high value conversation.
Now, that is the kind of meeting actually worth clapping for.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We hope you take this rigorous precision-first mindset and apply it to your own lead generation architecture.
Thanks for listening.
Until next time, keep learning, keep questioning, and we'll catch you on the next one.